Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
The usual narrative is that Hitler was the main animating force behind the Second World War. But the historian Sean McMeehan argues that that isn't strictly true. Stalin had a major role to play in generating war in the first place and gain the most from it. Sean is the author of Stalin's War, and he joins us now on News Talk. Afternoon, Sean.
Good afternoon.
Now, it says in your book that it was the war that Stalin wanted, not Hitler. Did he actively want a war?
Well, I think he wanted a war at some point. It's not that he knew precisely when the war would break out and in what form, but he was definitely preparing for war. What I mean by it was the war that Stalin wanted was that he wanted a European war in which he did not at first have to take part. That is to say, he actually liked the idea of Hitler and the Western powers destroying one another. To some extent, everyone was still, I suppose, living with the memory of the First World War and the carnage. But for the Russians, it was on the Eastern Front. Of course, for Britain and France, it was on the Western Front. And there was a little bit of mirror imaging where, you know, in Stalin's mind, the Western powers wanted Hitler to fight him. And in his mind, he wanted them to fight Hitler. That is, he preferred to have a kind of war of attrition. And at some point, he was hoping to enter the war. But he hoped that by then, the Western powers and Hitler would have exhausted each other. Mm. So that effectively it would be kind of easy pickings.
And was he prepared for such a war? And were his military commanders telling him he was prepared for such a war?
I don't think he was prepared. He certainly wasn't prepared in 1939. I mean, I think there's no doubt about that, particularly after the purges of 37 and 38 in the Soviet officer corps. Was he ready by 1941? By June, no. I think they were hoping to be close to ready by later that summer, and perhaps by 1942 or 1943 at the latest. It's not that he had some master plan, I don't think, drawn up with a precise timetable. But really, in a sense, he had been preparing for war ever since launching the first five-year plan in 1928. He just didn't know exactly when and how it would start.
Yeah. And did anybody from the records, was anybody advising him against, I suppose, and this is all counterfactual, given in retrospect, the massive human cost it cost the Soviet Union, certainly on their Western Front, that was anybody advising this mightn't be a good idea?
Well, I haven't found any such evidence, although, of course, we have to consider that by about 1936-37, and certainly by 1938, there really wasn't much of an opposition left to the Soviet Union. That is to say, people who might have been senior enough to even venture a serious contrary opinion. Molotov, after he had ascended to the control of the Commissariat of Foreign Affairs in May 1939, one could see perhaps Molotov having the seniority to be able to offer at least a mild dissenting opinion. But you can see this even in the case of the Finnish War, broke out in November 1939 with the Soviet invasion. Even though there certainly were commanders, Meretskov is a good example, the person who was kind of tasked with actually preparing for that war. And he was definitely cautious, and you can kind of read between the lines and see that he didn't really think it was a very good idea. That said, he didn't actually stand up and offer any pointed opposition, so to speak. So no, I don't think there's necessarily that type of what you might call a dissenting opinion. What you see right before June 1941 is rather that everyone is pretty sure the Germans are preparing to invade, and they're a little bit desperate because they don't think the Red Army is ready. They don't think they've been able to camouflage the bases and all the rest of it. And the real dispute you see between Stalin and his generals right before June 1941 is that Stalin is a bit more disbelieving about German intentions. You know, I don't think he was completely flummoxed and shocked, but that said, he still thought that it might have been a bluff, whereas his generals were actually just looking at the more, you know, the hard evidence on the ground and saying, no, look, the Germans are absolutely poised to invade. You know, that's the only real, I think, conflict that you might see. It's not even necessarily whether fighting is a good idea, it's just whether the Germans are on the cusp of invading or not.
And then when the Soviet Union became an ally, and nobody thinks of Stalin as a master diplomat, but is it fair to say your contention is he really played Roosevelt and Churchill?
Oh, I think he did. But, you know, again, how much he was a master diplomat and how much they simply wanted to be played at times conceived at times, just I think it's kind of what they wanted to do anyway. I mean, in some ways, Churchill's a more interesting case. I mean, I'll get to Roosevelt in a moment, but what's so fascinating about Churchill, I mean, he's a man of so many contradictions and kind of big ideas and big notions and this mercurial, I call it, approach to statecraft, is that he had actually been trying to cultivate Stalin even before the Germans invaded. He had sent a number of private personal letters to Stalin, which Stalin had not answered, basically because he was loyal at that time to his pact with Hitler until June 1941. So Churchill had been trying to cultivate Stalin. And so in some ways, he was almost primed for what happened. That is to say, when the Germans finally invaded, I mean, to him, it was a great relief. It was basically what he had been hoping for, was that the relief would be taken off of Britain's overmatched armies and that he would have an ally in the war. And so for Churchill, at first, it felt a little bit like deliverance. And so I think he wasn't necessarily thinking entirely clearly. So there are these impulsive decisions. He immediately sends over the 200 Hawker Hurricane pursuit planes that supposedly were destined to defend Singapore against Japan. He sends lots more fighters and even bombers, some of them reconsignments from Britain's own lend-lease, consignment from the United States, that is. They're sort of reassigned to Stalin. And then even tanks, amazingly, by the end of the year, despite Britain's own depleted tank park. I think Churchill, much more than Roosevelt, eventually came to see that there were some real dilemmas there. That is to say, eventually, by 1943, they stopped sending the Soviets aluminum because he realizes Britain's own ability to manufacture arms and particularly warplanes is actually vulnerable. Eventually, he kind of realizes that Stalin has these very imposing and aggressive war aims in Eastern Europe. In Roosevelt's case, it's such a fascinating thing. I think Roosevelt really felt to some extent, I mean, he was in a very powerful position in one sense. He could make a lot of choices that Churchill, far more desperate, really couldn't make. And in a curious sense, Roosevelt chose Stalin over Churchill. I mean, the way he actually negotiates with the two of them is fascinating. The U.S. drives a ferociously hard bargain with Britain when it comes to things like bases for destroyers in 1940, where effectively, Britain mortgages her Western Hemisphere imperial interest to the United States in exchange for these kind of decrepit World War I area destroyers. And then they charge steep interest for all of the lend-lease loans. And they force Britain to pay up. I mean, right until 2006, Britain is still paying down these debts, whereas Stalin essentially got everything virtually for free. That is, Roosevelt just decided that to some extent, he thought that the Soviet war against Hitler was so valuable that he prioritized it even over the war against Japan, which in retrospect is kind of astonishing vis-a-vis the news from Pearl Harbor in December 1941. That is, when it came to things like merchant shipping and convoys, he actually prioritized Stalin's war fighting needs. In fact, I mean, they basically put this in writing at the Arcadia conferences after Pearl Harbor in December 1941, where Churchill, and again, Churchill, to the extent he even really has his own authority. It's a little bit like, let's say, Daladier vis-a-vis Chamberlain at Munich. You know, Churchill doesn't have full freedom of action. He kind of has to go along with what Roosevelt wants for a lot of the war because he needs American funds. He needs American arms. But what the Americans get him to agree to, and part of it he does agree, the part he does agree with is that Nazi Germany is a higher priority than Japan. The part that he was kind of forced to agree with is that the U.S. should actually prioritize, and they put this in writing at Arcadia, in basically the Russian front, the Eastern Front in Europe, that's the highest priority as far as the allocation of resources.
Yeah. Is there, I suppose this is in retrospect, so it's easy to say, but is there any point where perhaps they could have or should have cut off the aid or vastly reduced that aid, and it mightn't have necessarily led to the division of Europe afterwards?
I certainly think there is a time. Politically, it obviously would have been difficult, partly because these things take on a momentum of their own. The way they actually wrote up the Lend-Lease statutes, there actually was a sunset clause. And effectively, anytime after June of 1943, they needed a full reauthorization from Congress. And it just turned out they actually kind of scheduled the Soviet protocols to coincide with this. So the second Soviet protocol was supposed to end on the 30th of June 1943. So that might have been one obvious moment. That is, after Stalingrad had already happened, and effectively the Soviets had assured they wouldn't collapse. Because after all, in the first run, that makes say. See why Churchill says, look, we have to bail out the Soviets. We can't let the front collapse. And the Americans obviously feel the same way, in part because it's going to take them so long to mobilize their own forces. And you can see the logic of that kind of right up to about Stalingrad and maybe even to Kursk, which just happened, the Battle of Kursk in July 43, which just happened to be a few weeks after the end of the Second Protocol. The way they wrote it up, though, it was kind of politically very clever. It wasn't just that they gave most of the authority to Roosevelt and the so-called good faith clause to just determine who was eligible for the vast hydraulic resources of the U.S. war economy. But effectively, all countries were rolled together into one resolution. So even if there were a lot of congressmen and senators, and there were, who were very wary of Stalin and didn't really like the idea of sending this vast amount of aid to Stalin's armies, they would have also had to vote against aid to Britain and China and a lot of other countries where there really wasn't such opposition for good reason, because of course the cause was much clearer. Britain, after all, had been essentially first after France, you know, kind of Britain fighting alone, China obviously bearing the vast brunt of Japan's armies, at least on land. You couldn't possibly oppose those things politically. And so politically it was very difficult. But that said, if there had been the kind of the backbone to stand up to the Roosevelt administration, Congress, and, you know, put some conditions down, maybe not to cut it off entirely, but perhaps to slow it down, apply some conditions, I think 1943 would have been the time, not least because that's also the time that the U.S. and Britain finally kind of move into the continent of Europe. You know, they move into Sicily and then Italy. They're preparing for what will eventually become the D-Day landing, so that the fighting burden is kind of equaling out. The Soviets are obviously not as desperate. And there were people who began to make that argument in late 43 and early 44 in the U.S. camp. You know, in Britain, as I said, kind of quietly, they'd already begun to scale down some of their own contributions to the Soviet war effort. But the U.S. was actually ramping things up in 43 and 44. Mm-hmm. And there were voices even among the people who were in the U.S. Embassy in Moscow or attached to the U.S. Embassy saying, look, they're not even telling us how they're using all these weapons. We're not really sure they need them. You know, we're sending them things like marine diesel engines that they weren't even using, which were desperately needed, actually, for the amphibious invasion of France. And they're actually sending more of these to Russia, and they weren't even using them than they were to Britain. You know, there are these anomalies and almost absurdities in the aid program. But, you know, in the end, it's just it was a bit like spitting in the wind. It's just the Roosevelt White House had kind of made this commitment, and it just had this momentum. I mean, it was just hard to stop.
Yeah. Sean McMeekin is Professor of European History and Culture at Bard College and the author of Stalin's War. Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.